Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson, with Mage the Podcast, and today's episode is a recording I did at PAX Unplugged in Philadelphia, December of this past year, with Mike A. of Darker Days Radio and Pukuji of Changeling the Podcast on our experience of PAX, how RPGs work at this particular convention, what we'd like to see, and some other behind-the-scenes stuff about producing podcasts.
I do at one point compare playing Dungeons & Dragons to heteronormative sex in that it kind of has an implied default to it. If that bothers you, that occurs around the 18-minute mark and you can just like jump ahead 30 seconds.
Shout out to Benji, Adam K, Sean M, Janine V, and Mike M that I ran into at PAX Unplugged as well. It was nice to see all of you. In other news, our regular release schedule will probably be returning in May instead of June. I've decided ultimately not to sit for my big dumb test this year. A few things have gotten in the way, such as water that's normally on the outside of the house being more on the inside of the house than I would have preferred. That's going to take some work. Also, Visions and Vistas, the Mage the Podcast Storyteller Vault supplement on the Umbra. I have received a total of 42,500 words for it so far. That's about the size of an old tradition book. We'll be working our way up to probably about 60,000 words when we get all the connective pieces and other submissions in. That's a newer tradition book, but not quite the size of one of the Malcolm Shepard ones. Anyway, I wanted to update you on what was going on, but in the meantime, here's a conversation at PAX Unplugged with Mike A. and Pukuji. On with the show. Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson, with Mage the Podcast, and I'm being joined today at PAX Unplugged in the City of Brotherly Love, Philadelphia, also known as Chicago, if it hated you.
Oh.
And I'm that is the most accurate descriptor I think I've ever found of the city so far. Like, what if Chicago didn't like you? And joining me today are from Changeling the Podcast, Pook.
Ahoy, hoy.
And Mike A. from Darker Days Radio.
Hey, how you doing? I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Pook, are you you solid? Solid today?
I'm mostly plasma more than solid. But
whoa, whoa, that's exciting. Funny. That's
we
exciting.
Should have an electrifying interview.
That's hey, you're talking the only about pun I've ever Philly made. And Chicago. You reminded me there was one time my aunt was talking about Chicago is the city of big shoulders from the, I think it's Carl Sandburg poem. And so we were trying to think up similar monikers for Philadelphia and just like one upping each time. I think we settled on the city with six toes. And that, I think that's well, silly.
The way I described it is when people make a Philadelphia tarot, they want Gritty to be the devil. Gritty is the Hierophant.
Oh, yes.
Yes. He is spreading wisdom. He is speaking the sacred texts. Yep. I think my favorite one is when the two favorite Gritty incidents I have are when Gritty executioner style took someone out at a Flyers game with a t-shirt cannon.
Gritty
just started firing
at
random, and this one assistant is just running away, and Gritty looks at the audience and everyone cheers, and Gritty turns the t-shirt cannon at the back of this person and just beams them in the back of the head, and the body hits the ice. Gritty's hands go up and the crowd goes wild, and you just see this person's leg twitch. The other one was the shirtless Gritty saying, Gritty declares all bodies beach bodies, no diets, just riots. And I think that's an acceptable message for an anthropomorphic puppet.
Yeah.
So
it was kind of a startling ascension from like beloved misfit to leftist icon as
well.
So,
Yeah.
It's kind of like how the Babadook became a gay icon.
Yeah,
you're like, I couldn't have predicted this, but here we are.
Yeah.
So Mike, you're the non-local here.
Yeah.
What is your experience of Philadelphia? You've come to PAX Unplugged a number of times.
I mean, I like it, but I'm also like, what the hell is going on here?
Exactly.
You know, sometimes like where I'm staying right now, north of the convention center, I'm like, okay, I'm walking through. I'm like, this is fine. Ooh, this is, there's a lot of barbed wire here and a lot of U-Hauls. Okay. Oh, hey, this is nice again. This is great. It's great. Nice brownstones. Oh, geez. My Airbnb is a bad spot. I can say
it's surprisingly stochastic. You thought it would be a more gradual rise and descent. No.
Really isn't.
Block by
really
block.
Isn't.
Yep. Yeah. Swarovski crystal lead paint dispensary. Yeah, it's just right next to each other.
But food wise, incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible.
Yeah.
City. Yeah. The convention. If anyone comes to PAX Unplugged, which you probably should, it's right next to Chinatown. There's a lot of great options. I know that Puka went to ramen just before this. Puka, did you go to ramen in Chinatown or elsewhere?
Oh, Chinatown, of course.
Yeah. I can tell you as well, you're locals, you probably know about this, but there's this cyber noir ramen place about like five blocks south if you're a Chica as well. I don't know if you've been there. But
I haven't been. I've heard of, but I haven't been yet. I used to go, the one that we went to for dinner in my day job, in my other life, I work across the street, which is has been convenient in the past when PAX has happened. But I used to go to this ramen place for lunch all the time, so I have deep affection for it. They have lots of manga paintings on their walls and stuff.
Which, oh, sweet.
You know, it's nice.
It's a good vibe.
I feel like with enough planning, we could all do like a Yakitori Boy session after this at some point. Ooh. So Yakitori Boy is a serves Yakitori and also does karaoke.
What is your go-to karaoke song, Terry?
Am I trying to show off or am I trying to get everyone going?
A little of this, a little of that.
If I'm just trying to get everyone going, Mr. Brightside.
Oh, okay.
I got one note and everyone knows the words and it lets the whole audience calibrate to it. That's a real easy one.
Okay.
So, tends to be my go-to. Lollipop by Mika is my backup because people don't anticipate that a 330-pound baritone can both do that kind of affectation and have that kind of range. But if I know it's coming, I can prepare for it. So, I can do one split if you give me a couple days notice and I don't have to do a second one. That's my relationship with certain karaoke songs.
Mage patrons who back enough and come to PAX Unplugged can see this next year.
Yeah, the supporters at the Oracle tier. So.
What's after Oracle? Is there any exemplar? Is that
That would be Ascendant is probably where I would go with that. Bodhisattva possibly, Singularity Emeritus would be another thing.
Guilty.
Cool. Certainly appreciate. I had to replace the day before I went on a 4-week out of town trip. The storage controller on my motherboard blew, which both destroyed the backup operation I was doing after 16 hours of editing that day and corrupted the data on the two hard drives that were attached to it. So that was that was an interesting thing. When you've got 180 gigs of recorded audio, it's all backed up, but my home internet connection became the bottleneck in recovering that. And it's like, oh, this is going to take 4.1 days, assuming nothing bad happens. This is going to be fun. But such is the way of things.
Yeah.
But
I don't know how Darker Days Radio handles it or anything. But just,
$0 in 15 years.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that sounds great.
It's totally free.
You sometimes, though, have the benefit, though, of having a built-in audience that whenever one of your members does a publication, it's pretty easy to point your audience at that and to discuss it. And that certainly has its benefits. I know that everything I produce will go silver.
Yeah.
I think you're probably in the same category, more or less, no? Except for maybe Bog Bodies.
Bog Bodies is closing in on copper.
Okay.
Closing in. it's almost there.
I got to hear about this one.
So, all right, Bog Bodies. I'm very proud of it, and I wish more people...
Because I found it in the process of backing up. I forgot that you and I did an interview literally the day before Christmas last year.
I've been too polite to bring it up since then.
please don't be.
All right, well, thank you. I appreciate it. But Bog Bodies is... I have always had a soft spot for Mummy the Resurrection, despite having very little connection to it. And there's like a throwaway line here and there, I think probably also in the old Mummy books, about mummies elsewhere in the world, among whom are the bog mummies of Northern and Northwestern Europe. So I was like, someone should do a book about that. Why not myself? And there is no Mummy 20th Anniversary Edition, so I kind of cobbled together some 20th Anniversary rules applied to the mummy lore and everything from the revised edition and made Bog Mummies. That's my story.
Love it. That's awesome. So, that's great. And that's one of the really great things about like Storyteller's Vault is grasping onto cool ideas that were just throwaway lines and expanding them. I've got a book that I wrote 4 years ago that's still not been published, but maybe sometime soon, which is based off of such throwaway lines kind of related to World of Darkness. So,
hey, if you get the words, there's a bunch of us that will get it over the finish line.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, this one, it's already written. It's already in layout. It just needs the character sheet. That's it.
Okay, so we're all waiting on Chris Leland then.
Pretty much.
I hope every fandom has a Chris Leland in the same way that, like, in the world of the Dark Towers, the Rose exists across all universes. I just assume that Chris Leland, Mr. Gaughan, who has created all character sheets...
For decades.
Yep.
For decades.
Yep.
And some of the most esoteric ones where people are like, I need a V5 Abominations character sheet for Garal that has become, and it's there.
Yeah. I love just looking at his website and being like, who asked for this? Who needed Resident Evil World of Darkness?
Yeah. What percentage of each recording, for both of you, would you say that you cut?
Not a 5%.
Okay.
Maybe, I am all over
maybe,
the place.
Maybe less. It depends.
If someone is not a confident interview or is bad at staying on topic, it is not uncommon that I will keep 55 to 60% where I still try and keep an episode tight. I take Roman Mars' advice. Every minute you save, if you have 1,000 people in your audience, saves 13 hours of human time. Yeah. And I try and be friendly towards that. I got into a period where I overcut episodes, and it sounded like the Micro Machines guy just going back and forth. And so, that's a knob I need to do. There are certain guests that I have where a one-hour interview will take me, because I listen to it at 1.7x speed, when I'm editing, will take me 45 minutes to edit, and it will be 58 minutes at the end of that because I had to remove somebody sneezing or maybe the doorbell going off. And those are glorious.
Yeah.
I will keep names anonymous, but Osh Eth, Uka E, and Ichter Inzer are notables in that, where wherever they're like, oh yeah, we can do this, I'm like, oh thank goodness, this is going to take me 10 minutes to do. Both of them were secretly newscasters in a past life. But yeah, a lot of hesitant ones. It's usually when someone is very considered, where they say a sentence, they pause for a couple seconds, they maybe say it again. Those are easy to edit, but that's something where a two-hour conversation becomes a 50-minute episode for me.
Yeah,
I don't feel bad about that at all. So you were talking about bog bodies. Yes. Having gone out into the world, I do think we should do a book and call it a mage book and basically be strange consorts or something like that. Because I just feel the moment you call it mage, it's going to move more compared to that generic World of Darkness.
Absolutely.
That's just
it will.
Yeah. So I want to do one on basically people who either mortals who grew up in the Umbra and are Umbra touched, or mages that are kind of in the same way that in Exalted, Abyssals are like, well, I can let you die or you can choose to serve me, that more or less the same thing happens, but with Paradox, where there are a certain class of Paradox spirits that are kind of the inside guy in terms of cosmic balance. And I think anytime you put three of them together, you can call it a Compendium Volume 1, and that just... People love that.
People love that. Yeah. Volume 1, Volume 2. Promise a Volume 3, but don't release it.
Exactly.
Put an ad for it at the back and then just...
Cover art is the absolute last thing I do, so I would never be able to do that. But Mike, you assist with running kind of the RPG free play. Can you give us kind of a snapshot of what RPG stuff at PAX is?
Yeah, so we have a lot going on for role playing games at PAX. I work in the RPG department here, which kind of manages the free play tables for attendee run games primarily, and also a few small sponsors and publishers like Bodana Group and others. We also have a lot of partners that are running games, such as Free League, and we've got Games on Demand, who run tons of different indie games. Paizo's here, WotC as well is doing some demos, I believe, and many other things. And I think next year we're going to get even more publishers partnering as well. We've had quite a few conversations. So it's a whole mix of people that are passionate about games running them just because they're excited, and also people demoing games because they're popular right now and people want to run them. We also, this year, brand new, have our Alexandria Game Library partners running a couple games, usually like old school ones that are people really excited about and have a lot of interest, but maybe not a lot of DMs or GMs these days. Mm-hmm. So I saw like some old classic Shadowrun there, old like Star Trek role-playing games and other things. So a lot of really cool stuff going on. So definitely if people are interested and you're in the Philly area, swing on by, come to PAX Unplugged, play some RPGs, or even run some for your friends.
The setup seemed to be that there was an open registration that for a lot of them happened very early in the morning, and you could do that either through the app or in person and kind of run with that. And for that, for a lot of the publishers, it seemed to be you put your name into a hopper and then you got a time later in the day where you could then re-sign up for the specific game, seemingly. Like Free League had a thing where they took 40 entries in the morning and you could sign up. And when you got there, they had a certain mix of Dragonbane or Tales from the Loop or whatever. And then as you just went through that second line, hopefully you would kind of get the game you want.
Yeah, it was a bit of an interesting choice. You know, some people are just excited to play any game that's by Free League because they have so many great things, and a similar engine in a lot of cases. Yeah. You know, it's the Year Zero engine. But yeah, if you specifically wanted to play the One Ring and then you end up with Morkborg, it's a bit of a change right there.
Yeah, or wind up with The Walking Dead or something like that. Yeah, yeah. A little bit of a tonal shift.
Yeah, so I mean, I can say we're talking to them about maybe switching things up because the sampler works for some people, doesn't work for others. And having more options, I think, is better definitely in the future. So we'll see what happens. And other way, I think it'd be pretty good.
And kind of the other way to run games, seemingly, is to be a entity that runs games. friends of the show, at least in previous incarnations of Gehenna Gaming, is just kind of mm-hmm. doing their own thing and is kind of set up to be their own entity. So do we form a small LLC and just start running games next year? Or
I mean, if you want to, that'd be pretty sweet. And you know, there are some little rooms that just have four tables, six tables, that sort of thing. So if you get a couple of storytellers, you could do some highbrow, high magic, modern storytelling, for example.
I do like the idea that we would use mise-en-scene to separate us from the other groups and be like, they have exceptional decor. Storytellers, dumpster fire. But aromatherapy candles out the wazoo. And that could be, that's what would fill our experience here.
Also, the fact that we're using mise-en-scene as a term here, I mean, that's the highbrow part, I feel.
Yeah.
I did watch a Wes Anderson movie last night. There you go. French Dispatch, I very much enjoyed it. It was either that or actually play The Walking Dead.
Okay.
So, like, nope, Wes Anderson.
You made the right choice.
I think I did. Mm. I think I did. I haven't played anything with the Year Zero engine. Are you familiar enough to get, like, a high level, like, is there anything about it that you know that is like, oh, this is the cool thing this does?
Man, you know, I don't think I've ever actually played it. Yeah, it has a lot of mechanics involving stress, and that's how they kind of separate it from a lot of other games, but I'm going to defer to Puka, maybe. Maybe you got something, Puka, here?
No, I do not.
None of us know anything that's going on. Maybe you should cut this from the episode. Yeah.
I will say
I always leave in my own incompetence and cut that of others.
Okay.
So it'll just be me going, durr.
Stress mechanics are already something that are present in my life, so I don't know that I need to role playing.
I have a prescription to deal with stress mechanics, yes. You're like, oh no, my appraisal aim is hitting zero.
It is the kind of thing, though, that when you come across an esoteric mechanic, and you're curious to see how it unfolds in a game. Like, you can conceptualize it, but then you're like, does this actually work for any given table that tries this game? And I get the feeling sometimes, not that it's not a case necessarily of why fix what isn't broken, but I feel like there are only so many ways to slice the pie when it comes to fundamentally, you are picking up some dice and throwing them down. You have some numbers on a sheet that may or may not change. And so the innovations that I think attract me more are kind of ones that have more to do with narrative that define the role of the player versus the storyteller, the DM, GM, whatever, in different ways.
So do you like, in that case, kind of digging more into the mechanics, you like little bennies and counters that you can use to influence the story, that sort of thing?
I think I would. Yeah. I did a brief interview earlier with Stephen Carey, Casey, feel bad, I don't remember his last name off the top of my head, but he did the 10 Candles game, and he had a new one that's called We Serve Her Wintry Hunger, and it's inspired by Yuki Onna. And so he was explaining kind of the mechanics, one of which is over the course of the game, you are cutting out a paper snowflake, and then at the end, everyone reveals their paper snowflake. But if you, as a party, have not succeeded in pleasing your wintry mistress, then slowly the snowflakes get destroyed. And I've never heard a more changeling style of gaming in my life.
Stephen Dewey.
So, Dewey, yes.
Yeah. I always go back and forth on games that have character mechanics versus player mechanics. Like, one of the things I kind of like about the old World of Darkness, and I mean World of Darkness in general, is everything you do, your character is doing.
Yeah.
Like, there isn't a momentum pool. There isn't some exogenous rewrite mechanic that lets me influence it and say, I, as the player, am going from actor to editor, to use stance theory to explain that. And I think there is something a little bit powerful to that. I think when you start making that wall a little bit more wavy, I think it makes people ask a lot of questions about a game. The best comparison I've had recently is a lot of those gaming mechanics are the gaming equivalent of non-heteronormative sex, in the sense that guy and a girl, there's a default. And most people are perfectly fine with that default and never say, do we want this to be the default? But the moment it's not heteronormative sex, you got to go in and go, so what are you looking for? Or what do you want? Like, how do you want this to unroll? There is no default for it. And I think a lot of these games that do interesting work break that default in a way that players aren't sure what to do with it, even though ultimately for their overall gaming health, it would result in them having more fun. And I think that's a surprisingly accurate analogy, but I don't know.
I mean, I've got my queer theory lecture notes in my bag if you want me to whip those out and start going through. But would you say also, though, that people, like, they have their first game system, which, like it or not, is almost invariably D&D, and then everything else kind of gets assessed in relation to that first experience?
Maybe not the first experience. I think it's going to be the most, the game you play the most. Yeah. Which is, I guess,
you
know, kind of...
It's the fact that it's D&D, plus then they played it for 5 years.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, my first game was Tunnels and Trolls. Okay. Which I don't know if you ever played. It's D&D with a bunch of D6s, basically.
And the dungeon levels up, not you, right?
you both level up.
Okay.
And kind of. That's kind of how it works, essentially, with the game and how the little adventures are written. I know it's kind of splitting hairs, essentially, but that's really the way I would look at it. But I concur that, yes, the things that you're most familiar with are what you're going to be judging everything against.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all know people that have played Shadowrun for X number of years. Shadowrun third, basically, and that's all they play.
Is it third where if you get hit by a bicycle, it does more damage than a bulldozer?
Probably.
There's one where it's like damage from a vehicle is based on speed, not mass or something. So anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it's mutual friend Chig loves to bring up in Shadowrun first edition, you can do brain surgery if you know how to operate a boat. It's only 1% chance, but you can do it.
I'm going to jet ski my way through your corpus callosum.
But let's get back to the core point that you're bringing up, how we all judge based off, most people judge based off of the game that they're most familiar with, that they've been playing for a long time. How do you think we break out of that mold to really start? Is it just, you know, going out there and just playing these other games? Is it really considering them, thinking about them, having like a debrief afterwards?
I think you need to have somebody running the game for you who is very invested in understanding where you're coming from as a player and invested in positively breaking you out of that mold. If you are, I don't want to say necessarily stuck in your way of thinking about how to role play, but if you've been playing D&D for 5 years or whatever, and you are interested in another game and you are like, yeah, I feel like I should learn that other game, you can't have just some DM who's like, okay, well, I guess I'll run this setting for you. You need someone who's passionate and is willing to work with you as an individual. But beyond that, I don't know that it really, we can make hard and fast claims about like what will and won't work for any given person. But that's my thought on it.
I mean, I think one of the issues that we run into is the fundamentally different treatment of time as adolescents, teens, college, and then kind of beyond. So like the comparison I'll make is if you're running D&D weekly, in a year, you may have 15 amazing game moments. Pukerai running a different game could run sessions where you have an amazing experience, but it's once a month. And if you just look over the course of the year, that D&D stretch where you were playing weekly for a year generated more memories. This is a phenomenon that's also known in a lot of location-based sports. So for instance, golf. You have your local course that you play every Saturday because it's 10 minutes from your house. And even if it's a shitty course, if you've played it 30 times, you've probably had some exceptional shots and experiences. And it's really hard for any other course to compare. In the same way that, like, I bake for my colleagues once a week, and whenever people are like, oh, can you make this? My grandmother used to make it. I'm like, no, I'm not going up against grandma. Like, even if mine is technically superior, I'm not going to be able to beat out the emotional valence. And to me, there's kind of two ways to deal with that. One is to create something different enough that it doesn't get a comparison to D&D, or something that is similar enough that it activates all the existing D&D nerves, but then you get to subvert it in some way, shape, or form. And I just don't think I'm smart enough to really do either of those. Like, I see a lot of games where it's like, oh, you're calling this an RPG, but this is a board game in the sense that they're a closed set of choices and narrative influence does not exist in that it can ultimately be viewed as a strictly strategic thing where agency is only resolved through pre-existing mechanics and not through players arguing, debating, and consenting. So if you don't have that, to me, you're a board game and it really scratches that itch. I think the other thing that D&D deals with is the fact that it's a game that in some way can be won. For instance, I had a housemate that was running a longstanding game, and it was from a thing. But they were doing Lord of the God Kings or the Tomb of the Immortal Space Bitches or something like that. And they're like, yeah, my group came upon this bridge and they all died. And we ended it. I'm like, why would you do that? And he's like, well, that's what the book said. But I knew they were all going to die. I'm like, then why'd you run it? Because that's what the book said. So there is one way of interpreting that in a very narrow sense if you do what the book says. But there's also another way of saying, well, the person who wrote this had a challenge in mind. And I would like to, it's like reading a novel. You don't change the events in the novel. Right. So I almost feel like a lot of other games fail to provide that experience of, hey, there was a challenge set out that someone who is familiar with the game posited for us, and we were able to triumph over it. We won this. And I don't know that a lot of games necessarily give that. So I always wonder to what extent that is influencing things.
Yeah. Can I tell a brief anecdote? Just, you made me think of a friend of mine when the D&D 5th edition update of, I guess it's Tomb of Horrors, came out, and infamously difficult to get everyone to survive at the end. So he was recounting how in his party they made it to like the final chamber with the Lich and had the big battle, and they all died except for one character who only escaped by diving through, there's a portal in the room that returns you to the top of the dungeon, but without any of your gear. So the character tumbled naked out of this portal outside of the Tomb of Horrors, and it's like, yep, that's the one person left to tell the story.
Brilliant.
That's the best possible ending for that module. But things like that, I mean, when people inadvertently or not make some kind of twist to the expected ending, that I think can be really satisfying, especially if you know it's going to otherwise railroad you into an unsatisfying one. So
yeah, I mean, I can see it kind of both ways. You know, I'm kind of curious, let's bring this back to World of Darkness a little bit. When you are setting up a chronicle, how much of a story do you have in mind? How much of like an end goal do you have in mind that you kind of want players to work towards? Because typically when I'm doing, let's say vampire, let's say hunter or something like that, I do kind of have an idea of like, I really want to not push, but encourage players towards this sort of an ending and sort of maybe a showdown basically at the end. Not saying like a combat or a fight or something, but I want them to have this sort of moral decision that they need to make, or some sort of a really discussion that they as players and or characters need to have before kind of resolving things in this specific city. And I think kind of having that sort of resolution as for the storyteller system can kind of bring that same kind of closure that D&D has. Do you see it a similar way or something completely different?
I think it depends on the game, honestly, because I'm more likely to have an end goal in mind probably with Changeling than with Mage or even Vampire. And I think that's because Changeling trades so heavily in narrative tropes, and like you're more or less in a fairy tale, you know, and those tend to have very defined arcs. I don't want to railroad my players, but I do know that by the end, I want them to similarly make a moral decision or whatever about what happens to the queen or whether to return the treasure or whatever. But it does feel like an end point. And it doesn't have to be the end of those character stories. We can then start a new story, but they do feel a little more defined. Whereas with Vampire, I think with Vampire, I'm more interested in developing the setting and making it much more sandboxy, because Vampire is very much like, here's every vampire in the city, here's all their connections. Mage, I just, whatever comes up.
Mage for me, as the World of Darkness game I've run the most of, is a case of having two tracks. One is, this is the interesting thing going on in the setting at any given time. So here are the agents in the world, and they're going along and they're evolving. And the players are getting information about how that is updating over time. So if you want to have your big bad, hey, there is a new church that has opened in the city of Philadelphia that seems to have exceptional attendance. Okay, cool. You can investigate it, you cannot. 2 months later, doesn't matter what you did. In the meantime, there's going to be a bunch of missing persons claims coming out to that, the characters. So I use what in Delta Green is known as the agenda system, where you have kind of four moments and the characters can intercede at any moment. But the key thing for me is there is rarely a way to just ride what I have provided from session to session, because I think you really have to, especially if you're going to manage emotional energy, be able to go back and forth between that big world event and what is important to your characters. So something I like from Invisible Sun is the idea of side scenes. A lot of games will just call them downtime, but I think side scenes are fundamentally different. A side scene is just a one player, one storyteller thing. It is not like, oh, I'm going to study my books of magic. So that tends to be the game I run, where the story is bouncing back and forth between those. And on a logistics level, I like that because we save the big plot for the one where all four of us can get together. But if only two people are available that Thursday, okay, we're just going to run two individual settings. So I have a world where things are happening, and if they don't intervene, something bad will probably happen, but they get plenty of warning. And I tend to do things that are time-based. So, for instance, if this can only be done during the Festival of Lunsavar. Like, there's nothing to do until then. You may as well explore your character's background and run a side thing or whatever. So that's kind of a big thing.
Using like the clock system, Blaze in the Dark, that sort of thing. Yeah. I like the side scenes that you're mentioning. I do the similar thing, but usually if I know that there's two characters that are, say, going to a location or something like that, I ask for, depending on the game, maybe banter or like encourage the two players to basically have a discussion because A, gives me a break, which is always nice. And then they really do actually start to get into philosophical debates a lot of times, which I think is great and really gets them much deeper into the setting. I think I always really appreciate that.
Something that I think has helped with that for me, especially during lockdown in 2020 and 2021, is using Discord a lot, because the way that I was running when I had my mage game during lockdown, we would meet every week and we would do online. Everyone would be there. But then at any other point between sessions in the Discord server, we had a few in-character channels, and it was certain locations in Philly because the game was set in Philly. Mm-hmm. And I just told players, you know, if you want to have a side scene and get one free XP, but you have to bribe them somehow, then they could just, you know, do a descriptive, so-and-so enters and sits down and does whatever, and I would bring in an NPC, and then there would just be this interaction unfolding text by text going back and forth over the course of a couple days. And I think part of that is because with role-playing games, I don't want to lump everybody into the categories of you're either an actor or a writer, because I don't think you have to be either or, and there's a lot of other sort of things on the edge. But I do think that those two buckets absorb so much of what goes into the experience. And for me, I'm much more of a writer, I think. I really enjoy developing these lush, descriptive, complicated backstories, which if I have to do it on the fly with everyone sitting and watching, I'm like, I can do it, but you're all going to be really bored by the end. Mm-hmm. So side scenes offer that as an outlet for that kind of, that aspect of role-playing and that engagement with the setting. So I found that really advantageous.
Yeah.
And I've just discovered as more time goes on, I don't really care about characters. Like, I appreciate them, but like, I'm interested in plot. I want to see things happen in the world. If you want to have your character development happen in the course of that, that's all well and good. This, like, this bus is going to move. You're going to have to pull on the little line if you want to do something else. But that's just me. And like, there was this whole thing over Bloodstained Love or whatever it was. And people were like, romantic embodiment. I'm like, lame. Like, you could, like, just the idea of someone like embodying a character so wholly is just so utterly alien to me as a person. So a lot of these questions I view as fundamentally different, because that's not what I'm there for. I want to see a world change, and your characters are in it. Yeah. And if they want to change too, that's fine.
I can see that.
And that's part of the reason why I'm a storyteller.
I mean, I see what you're saying. I like to make characters that I think are very interesting in changing that world. Mm-hmm. So I kind of disagree. You know?
Pardon me.
But are you talking about just player characters?
Disagreement is forbidden.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's a good point. Yeah, when I introduce an NPC, I want them to be them to be interesting and have a background and so on. But to me, it is the totality of the world shifting that I find interesting, as opposed to the individual characters. That's just me, in the same way that
But sometimes, and it takes a lot of player buy-in and knowledge of the setting, but you get a player character that fundamentally changes the way that you are thinking about the plot and the setting. And we get that. Yeah. That's the golden moment.
Yeah,
it doesn't always happen.
And the world has also changed in response to that, probably.
Indeed.
So
indeed,
it's I'm bad at keeping track of the clouds, but I love looking at the storm front. So that's kind of me. So I will come up with hundreds of NPCs, but rarely is any one of them used more than two or three times. If they do make it to that rarefied level, I'm like, hey, folks, I don't know where you want this character to go, but I think it'd be cool if your character starts getting hit on, if that's cool with you, because so far we've all been wizards and everyone's ignored the fact that people have feelings, wants, and emotional needs. So
how do you feel about the oft-stated precept that, like, the characters are, by virtue of being player characters, they are fundamentally more interesting than anybody else in the game world?
Obviously, that person has never played Hunter 5th Edition, where all of the villains are strictly more interesting than any of the characters.
Yeah.
Shots fired.
Yeah. I mean, they can be, but I have a hard time making... So sometimes people just don't make interesting to me characters. I have a hard time making that character interesting then. I'm not sure how I'm supposed to do that in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think coming up with a good interaction, you know, I always go back to vampires. So if you give them a cool sire, like, things get pretty interesting. So that's what I did in a recent game I was running. It's just like, oh, they have a lot of like spicy sires who have very interesting angles, and that actually kind of rubs off on them in a little bit. You know, mentors, changeling, what can we do for change? Cool guys in the Freehold, cool duke.
Yeah, I love cool dukes.
Yeah, I think you know, maybe if it's kind of a, you know, a character, let's not say it's a boring character. Let's say it's a character that's not very fleshed out when it's created. I think encouraging the player to flesh it out more by giving them interesting connections that you provide can be a great way to help expand things.
Yeah. Leading questions are generally the best way I have of doing that. And I still need to produce a Storyteller Vault supplement that is literally just a whole bunch of print these out and put them on index cards. And every half session, ask each player one of these things. You and another vampire have an unhealthy fear of a particular clan. What is it and why? I don't care what your answer is.
Yeah.
I do, pardon me. I don't care about the specifics of the answer, but just having an answer to work with is immensely useful.
Which I've told you before is a technique that I think is one of the finest storytelling techniques or game running techniques that I've encountered, because especially when those questions pop out of nowhere and they force you to think on your toes as a player in the mind of your character to an extent. So, yeah.
Please release that
for the vault.
Yeah.
Some people do have a tendency to make what I'll call archetypes, where you kind of already know the answer to all those, and that I find difficult to break. Where it's just like, how do we make this a little bit more complicated? I understand that you like the clarity of being the paladin, but like when you list your hobbies as prayer and brushing your horse, it doesn't give me a lot to work with. But then again, if the player's comfortable with that, that's fine. It's just kind of hard to keep that plot ball in the air.
I think we need to writer's room that one a little bit. Let's think about that. Because I've run into that problem so many times. I'm not sure, how do I get past it? How do I get past that just stereotype, which is a big thing in World of Darkness games?
Yeah, and it's handy as heck for NPCs especially.
Yeah.
I think it's good to think about what constitutes the archetype and asking questions or pointing to things that are just part of human experience that don't necessarily fit into that. So something like, they're a paladin. Everything about them is a paladin. That's their entire character. I would ask something like, what's the moment when you were most ashamed? Because shame never enters into the paladin equation.
Yeah.
So that gives it a bit of dimensionality, which, like, you know, barbarians. Okay, well, what's the fanciest dinner you ever attended? Something like that.
I like that. And I think also partially this depends on the crowds from which you are drawing.
Yeah.
I disproportionately am playing with people that haven't titter-pigged before.
What?
TTRPG, tabletop role-playing games, Titterpigged.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Wow.
I own Titterpigs.
Things are different in Philly.
Yeah. I owned Titterpigs.com for a while. That was pretty
fun. Did you?
Yes. I also have When Will You Mage? That was part of a...
Whenever I can, Terry.
Yeah, exactly.
Whenever I can.
All day, every day.
Yeah.
But, and that tends to have two responses. People who kind of go ape with it because they don't know that they can't. So I ran it for people who are part of my opera company a couple of times. And that's just been amazing, where it's like, I want a character by the name of Reginald Whipthistle who secretly wants to get away with as many murders as possible. And I'm like, yes.
Great. Let's do it.
This I can work with. So like, and the funny part is like, I wouldn't call that person a caricature. They are a little bit one-dimensional, but that one dimension is interesting enough. Like, you can have a one-trick pony if the trick is good enough.
Was that an actual anecdote, or was that extempore from
No, that was an actual anecdote. Accidentally committed a hate crime. The character never wound up living down. He thought he was...
Oh, dear.
This was a game of Blades in the Dark, and... Sorry, Blades in the Dark! And he thought he was getting a leap on this organized meeting of their foes, but actually had burned down the Lantern District's gay men's choir. So, and that kind of created a lot of repercussions.
Just to briefly bring it back, I once did karaoke with a gay men's choir, and it was such an insufferable experience.
Oh, yeah, it's...
But anyway, yeah, so... Anyway, role-playing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Bringing it back to the being here at PAX, so I know you've run umpteen one-shots. I'm like, I don't know how many you've run, but like, I have generally not run a lot of one-shots. I would like to run more. I might be running one tomorrow. And these kinds of decisions that you make, like, where do you draw the line, especially if you don't know your players and you're just getting whichever six people signed up? And how do you, I guess, thread the needle between making sure everybody feels like the level of investment they want to put in is being accommodated, because that's going to vary and go in lots of different directions. So what's your strategy for that?
I cheat and I say, I literally ask, what does looking cool look like for you? And it breaks down into a couple groups. One is, I want to roll all the dice, or I want to get the biggest number. And that's perfectly fine. Another person is, I want to hold up the Medusa's head at the end. Another person says, I want to have the best witty banter. And another person says, I want to make sure the group succeeds. Like, I am perfectly comfortable being the librarian that finds the cool fact that lets us defeat the Gorgon or something like that. And I generally found in the first 20 minutes of play, I can figure that out. And if not, at my first break, I ask that. So I take advantage of the fact that in a one-shot scenario, there's generally going to be, we stop for cookies or we stop for water or something like that. So that way I can see how much of that I can implicitly work from the notes I have written down. That's also my chance to say, hey, you haven't said much. Are you enjoying yourself? Because some people want to go and be quiet in a group of people, and that's fine too. And the person just goes, and sometimes the answer is, oh, I'm really waiting to use this ability. Well, it looks like it's my job to come up with a scenario to use this ability. The biggest one I run into is when someone says they want this, but they do this thing. But the other thing I also get at convention games is, like, you have to want to be here. You had to hit the button at 8 a.m. to join the game, and you get a description, and you have the pre-gens to work with. So, like, each of those acts as a layer of filter to get rid of people who would reject the premise, which tends to be the deadliest thing. Well, I don't think my character would do it. Okay, we need to come up with a character that is going to go into the Tomb of Infinite Horrors, because that's where the plot is. This game is stupid. Okay, well, the four of us are going to have a lovely game. And at this point, I've literally never had that happen. I have introduced 160 people to Mage, and it just hasn't happened yet. The closest I've gotten is someone saying, I don't know the game world well enough to be able to answer your hypothetical question. And I just kind of go, like, when I say, what does your effect look like? Like, what is the qualia or effect of it? Like, I don't know. Blue sparks. Great. Okay. I will run blue sparks. I'm glad that your prayer generates blue sparks.
So is God.
Yeah. So that is both how rarely I deal with it and how I do that calibration.
Yeah. I haven't really run into much of an issue, basically, going back to your original question. Typically, people are at PAX, at least. And, you know, people are pretty excited to be playing the game. It's something they're interested in and haven't really had an issue. I think, generally, my take is that I just try to make sure that everyone's included. You know, if you're running, say, a World of Darkness game, having some sort of a, like, energizing scene or feeding scene, that kind of thing, exploring that for the individual character, I think is good for players to start to get into the setting. And that's really something when I'm doing a World of Darkness one shot is something I put up front just to make that an option. So, you know, basically, like, going into the Umbra, you're playing Werewolf. I haven't done Changeling, but I would assume some sort of a glamour scene for each character straight up front.
You'd be surprised how many people have no interest in doing a glamour gathering scene, in my opinion. And I'm throwing a bit of shade on the player base.
Well, I mean, that's this is the World of Darkness thing right here. But, you know, with older World of Darkness games, feeding could be a little boring sometimes. Maybe just...
Gotta
fill the gas tank.
Yeah. But this is a vampire specific question, because it's one of my biggest pet peeves with vampire.
Sure.
When people want to do hunts and just, like, not think about any of the mechanics of it, go through any of the consequences in particular. Yeah. And, like, I understand, not everyone wants to sit through everyone else's hunt. But I do think it's important that everyone at least gets a little bit of experience with it. And it's going to be different for every table. I like to say somebody should do a hunt once each session. It can be a 3-minute scene or a 5-minute scene or whatever, but just at least one person should.
Do you do the same thing for glamour gathering for a changeling as well? I think that's great, because, you know, it forces them to interact with their muse, for example, to do ravaging as well, you know, if that's the option that they're going for. But do you have a gradual reduction in your glamour over time in the same way as...
Yeah, and not, each day as a changeling, you have to spend a point. Spend three points.
I mean, I don't want to say that, but that's the kind of thing I'm thinking of.
Well, and it's changed in 20th anniversary edition too, but generally you lose glamour by either doing lots of magic or by using it to stave off banality. So rather than glamour eroding necessarily, banality ratchets up and you spend glamour to fight it back.
So I was just thinking about that in the fact that you can force people, if their glamour is automatically running lower between game sessions, for example, you force people to have to be doing that. But I understand as well that, you know, you don't want to force things and, you know, keep things flowing in a natural story way as well. But I mean, it's the key element to the game that makes many of these beings monsters, right? Yeah. You know, as well, it's so critical to Wraith that they go and they collect their pathos and, you know, have that interaction with the Skinlands. You know, it needs to happen every session, one shot. I would probably, I would have, maybe having everyone do it right at the start is not the best way of doing it. Mm. And that's something I should consider, but maybe have that scene for each player over the course of the one shot where they do that resource gathering or what have you.
Yeah,
I think the other problem that we run into is some people are not very good at modifying pace of play. So, for instance, a thing I played around with but I didn't get together in time was having the speed cube, which is in gameplay you have slower than real time combat where a 2-second gun battle will take us an hour and a half to figure out. You have roughly real time. Two characters literally talking to each other, that's roughly real time.
Yep.
Abstract moment where you have, maybe you're playing out an entire dinner party where Pook's group is breaking into the vault and Mike's group is taking down the alarm system while my group is just distracting everyone with witty banter. And a 4-hour dinner party we play in 2 hours, but across a bunch of people doing things. Then you have the research scene or whatever, which is an even further level of abstraction where you just do one role and that represents your day at the library. Or you could do information gathering at a party where one role represents all the socialites that you talk to. And then you have even faster where you can have several scenes or several activities kind of abstracted in one. The problem I run into is some groups don't realize you have all six of those settings at your disposal for any given scene. One of the things V5 does good at is, one, you can do turn by turn. You can do three rounds and out. You can do single roll resolution. Yep. Or you can say, you're an effing vampire. I'm going to get some slubs. You're going to take some damage, but you're getting out. And right there, it gives you four speeds of resolution. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the problems that people run into is they treat that feeding scene as functionally a combat scene, seemingly, where it's like, roll to open the window, roll to see if I slip in. And I'm not saying this happens in your game, but that kind of pacing, I can see instantly how that kills it. Whereas I would almost prefer the Invisible Sun method, where in Invisible Sun, when you do a side scene, you do a single draw from the sooth deck, you look at the number on it, and that tells you if it went good or bad.
So, single roll for these things.
And even if it's just something where you say, roll a 10-sided die, don't even give me a pool. And if it's a high number, tell me why it was a spectacular feeding and your gas tank is full or whatever, or a terrible feeding and you at best you came out even, and explain that to me. So I think being able to moderate that pace of play is tough because, again, there is that is a technology, and that technology has to be trained into both a player and a storyteller to allow that to be a narrative thing. I've had any number of games where I've been like, nope, you just succeed. You have 8 dice in your pool. There's no reason to roll. It would not add realism or interest to have this fail. And I've had players go, oh, wow, I really thought that was going to be the entire session. And I'm like, why would I do that to you? I also feel as if, going back to the 800-pound gorilla in the room, Dungeons & Dragons, it moves between those paces really well. It has no other speed of resolution for combat except for combat speed, and everything else just kind of happens at the speed that people say it does, because that's just kind of how the game unfolds. Yeah. So I almost wonder if that works in its favor.
Probably. And, you know, older and more experienced DMs will kind of realize that, like, you know, monsters have morale as well, so they'll just run away at some point, and that can speed things up as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to sit there duking it out with every single thing.
Caveat being that I think D&D in some ways has gotten back to its roots, because now it's like you have hex maps and mage. It's like, it can take, I mean, combat time, you may go through three rounds of combat, and that does take your entire day, because it does get so complicated, and people have 20 spell powers to draw on, and
Harkening back to one of Terry's earlier points just about, you know, testing out the waters with players, I think that having that resource gathering scene, whether it be feeding, whether it be working with morale, or in Wraith, you know, getting the gathering pathos, that can also help you judge the player's comfort level with the game and some more serious topics as well, you know, especially with Vampire, but as well as other games, you'll be able to see how they react. One time I was running Vampire, for example, and the gal who was doing a feeding scene kind of started cracking up, not because she thought it was funny, but she was so uncomfortable with the situation.
I call a Quentin Tarantino laugh.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, precisely. Precisely. So that really helped me kind of gauge things as well. These days, I usually use a consent form with one shots, for example, just to make sure that people are okay with things.
I have such mixed feelings over consent forms.
Oh, why? It's only been a boon for me.
I want to have some... There is an emerging body of literature that if we asked people just a long list of potentially triggering material, that just causes anxiety. Because frequently you're saying like you've done my mage one shot scenario.
Sure.
So if I were to use a generic form where it's like, are you comfortable with death and dismemberment? That is a useful thing to have on there. But for instance, and I'm not saying this is the form you use, but it's like, are you comfortable with sexual assault? Like that was never on the table.
No, I don't even
want that. But simultaneously, it's mage.
But
I don't know where it's going to go.
And you don't know where other players at the table are going to go.
Yeah.
So just because it wasn't in your game.
Yeah. So the thing I have done is, and this was something that was that I was able to do over. So you're giving people a list of triggering material. I don't like looking over it. And that's me.
Yeah.
And it's also one of those things where it's frequently just no. And then you also have the problem of, what are we interpreting green as? Is that a request?
And there's always that one. There's always that one guy.
Yeah.
Always a guy who says green all the way down. And I'm like, okay. And then, there's a lot of ways you can interpret it. And Puka, you seem to have an opinion. I'll let you go.
Before I start ranting. The one thing that worked, and this was the one upside of gaming during COVID, I could open a Google spreadsheet and just say, please write anything in here that you don't want appearing in the game. I have a line section and I have a veil section. We're not even going to talk about it. Every child in the setting is invincible.
Yeah,
All animals have 20 points of armor and 50 soak dice. And veils, we're only going to allude to it at best. Mm. And that you very quickly get towards, and I pre-populate it with a few things just so they kind of know, but that way it's not reviewing this large list and no one knows who put things in because you're using a Google Doc where all the input is anonymous. And that to me was the only upside to gaming over over the Panzerotti. But that's ultimately where I've come down. But yeah, there's a very visceral response I have to going through those things, especially if the thing I am worried about, like, so for instance, one of my lines is countercausal mind control. I'm fine if you influence someone's mood. I'm fine with puppetry, but I'm not fine with presence, as it were, or presence and dominate, not very comfortable with. Mind two, that's perfectly okay with me. Mind four, not okay with me. Not something I want to have in my game. And that just doesn't necessarily come up. And then you deal with these forms where it's like, to get to that level of completeness, oh boy. We're kind of going through a catalog in the DSM. So it is not me saying consent forms are a problem per se, but it's just when you optimize for one thing, I think you're de-optimizing for another thing.
Okay. I think I have something I want to follow up on this conversation, but I want to hear Puka's opinions of consent forms, if any.
And after this, I should probably...
Yeah.
I think the issue with consent form, I've never had a problem with them personally, but I hear these criticisms coming from a few different places and I understand them. I do think that people treat the consent form as kind of the beginning and the end of the process of hashing out what people are comfortable with, and obviously it shouldn't be. I feel like the better combination of strategies, like, first, you as a game runner need to decide what you are not comfortable with and make explicit from the start, like you're saying, children are invincible, etc., and saying, like, I'm not even going to put these on the list because it's not going to be an issue. Whether you're okay with it or not okay with it, it's not going to be part of the game. So that immediately reduces the list that people have to look through. I also don't think, I've never had a situation where consent forms were public. Like, so, you know, when you're talking about that part, I've always had them as things that are kept secret or things that are only given to the GM or whatever.
Yeah.
And But then also something that I feel like gets left out frequently, I don't think a lot of storytellers equip themselves with tools to handle it when the player comes across something that they didn't know was going to be a trigger. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that happened to me in the Mage game where, you know, I said, what's everybody okay, not okay with, you know, had a list, put together the first session, and we weren't touching on anything that people are uncomfortable with. Went through it, and afterwards one of the players said to me, listen, I didn't think this would make me uncomfortable, but I'm having like a panic attack over mm-hmm, it. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, we will put that plot thread to one side. We mm-hmm. will work out some way to kind of like wrap it up and transition to something else. And that was, I had to figure that out on my own because mm-hmm. there's no storytelling advice that I had come across which said, here's how to handle that specific situation with this thing that I didn't think was going to trigger anybody.
Okay.
So I think there's a range of technologies, to use your word, which kind of dovetail in different ways, but we need to be familiar with all of them.
Sure.
Absolutely.
That's a great point.
And again, to blame it on D&D, you have an understood milieu to the point where you know what the game's going to be and you don't have to go through this, where for the gay sex that is Old World of Darkness, you have to say, what do you... because we don't know where that game is going to go.
Yeah.
And if someone says, oh yeah, I'm afraid of my teeth falling out, that mm-hmm. could come up in a mage game.
It certainly could. You know, one of the things, and this is where I was kind of coming up with maybe like a simplification, is typically, you know, after I collect those consent forms, take a look at them, I go back to the players. I'm like, hey, all right, so I looked over everything. It seems like people are kind of looking for more like a PG-13 kind of game. Mm-hmm. And just using that kind of movie, you know, rating system, I think also kind of helps people just kind of set expectations, because you're not going to see some really, usually you don't see very gruesome stuff in the old PG-13. Rated R, yeah, we're going to have to talk about things a little bit more. So I was wondering if maybe that could be like an easy simplification just to bring to people. Something I also do, and maybe this is wrong, is typically I'll look through the forums and maybe I'll see a bunch of people say like, don't do anything to animals. I might just bring that up and say like, hey, I noticed like one or more people said that they really don't want to see anything happen to animals. So definitely let's avoid that. Particularly if I know there might be a ghost dog in my adventure. That happened once.
The one that I find interesting is how this interfaces with trope. So for instance, people will often say that I don't want any sexy times and I don't want romance in it. But it is not uncommon that if we are playing a game where you're a bunch of hyper competent people and you need to get a piece of information from the demure librarian, that suddenly people are okay with. You're like, oh, okay, I understand. We're going to do this. You're like, well, I just saw your hair from across the library and I knew you were the person who's going to have the information to me. That is, if I can keep myself under control, whatever it is. So it is not uncommon for me at the table to say, hey, this seems to be the direction that this is going, but the table didn't want this. Is it okay? And you can have a yes, no there.
Yeah.
May I propose a closing question?
Yeah. You'll fade to black. Yeah. Yeah. Get things done.
Pardon me. For conversation.
Oh, for us. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
Since we all need to go.
One of my veils is lengthy recording sessions.
Yeah. Lines for me. What game did you see here that you were kind of excited about that was either that you haven't had a chance to play yet?
I'll go not first.
Mine is The Electric State Free League. Very excited for that. Mm-hmm. So that would be the third game in the cycle of Tales from the Loop, Things from the Flood. The Electric State takes place in a vague, technologically advanced west of America that has given in to desertification after some sort of future war. And I have never cried reading a Simon Stalag book before, but I was just a snotty mess at the end of that book. Oh. And the setting and the way it unrolls, I think, is something I'm going to be interested in, as opposed to playing a Swedish teenager in the 90s or a Swedish kid in the 80s.
Yeah, that sounds really powerful. Gonna have to check that out. I think Puka already knows what I'm gonna say, and that's what I found in the Alexandria Game Library, the Dallas role-playing game. Yep, that's right. Yeehaw! Let's play a 1970s sitcom, I guess. I don't know. What is it? Drama?
Drama.
Yeah.
Wasn't that game considered like strangely ahead of its time in a lot of ways?
It was, yeah. Because of the serialized nature and everything. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, it was. Yeah, well, didn't sell very well.
Yes.
Can't imagine why.
System Mastery did a pretty fascinating episode on that that I'll include in the show notes for that. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I don't want to show favoritism among the ones that because I've been interviewing a few creators about their games, all of which I was interested in. So I want to pick one that I didn't interview the creator on. I actually saw one at the Indie Press booth, which a listener on Changeling the Podcast Discord server mentioned a couple days ago, and that's Bluebeard's Bride. And that one I almost bought from the beauty of the art alone.
I have all the books and supplements if you're interested.
Do you?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a fascinating game that's designed to be run as a single session, but yet they still produced $300 worth of material you can get for it.
Well, how about that?
But that is one where Julie, I think, would be fascinated to play anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I always kind of gravitate towards things that are, you know, postmodern takes on fairy tales and things like that. So that was one that caught my eye among many this weekend so far. And I'm sure I'll see many more tomorrow. But yeah. So.
Nice. Well, thank you for joining for this impromptu recording of an episode that will possibly go out in all of our feeds once I've edited it.
Happy PAX, everybody.
Stay classy. This has been Mage the Podcast, where the convention of our hearts, we're so glad you pre-registered. The show is made possible by our executive producers, who include Oracles embodying the following convention people. Ben Bendelow, Oracle of that guy who's always wearing a Star Trek costume. Buck Gregory, Oracle of that other guy always wearing a Star Trek costume. Christopher Phillips, Oracle of the one girl wearing a Battlestar Galactica costume, but you're not quite sure. Guy Stewart, Oracle of someone trying to convince you that the best board game ever is played entirely with bottle caps. Jay Widener, Oracle of that other guy who thinks that the world's best board game begins with at least 9,000 pieces. Josh Hillerup, Oracle of that random guest that you've never heard of that can seemingly fill the largest possible convention room. Mikhail, Oracle of the famous guy that you thought could fill a convention room but seemingly can't. Puka G, Oracle of people who travel to a new city and just find a McDonald's to eat at, making most of us cry. Sean Gallagher, Oracle of thinking that the Utilikilt will solve all of your problems. The crew of Erebus, Oracle of that guy who has no concept of what drinking water is. St. UX player, Oracle of those beautiful masochists who spend their entire vacation running games for free for other people. Sorcerer Sanguine, Oracle of the very confused faces of local store owners when they see so many people in Star Trek costumes. And Jason Vines, Oracle of that one guy in a Galaxy Quest costume that people keep thinking is in a Star Trek costume. Along with Archmaster Andrew Edelstein, Archmaster Brad the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Semsek, Archmaster Leroy Bryce, Archmaster Michael Parker, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Nathan Weaver, Wolf Larryson, Alex Alexia, Ambiversion, Anders S., Anon, Bederfi, Berto, Blaze Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Bubba the Pale One, Chris Blake, Sinchotis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scribner, Darren Hennessy, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Schwenk, Fragarock, George Lara, Guy with Puns, Henry Kraft, Hugo the Bog Person, Ia Bull, Jason Kennedy, Jason W. Briggs, Jay Gatsby, Jeff Brin, Jen, Jervis Johnson, John Magnuson, Jolan Andes, Laws and Stuff, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leslie Weatherstone, Manel Canos, Matthew Prohl, Maurice Hopkins, Michael Creedle, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick Mulder, Patrick McNamara, Rachel Grace, Ricardo, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Sev Nessa, Starfish, Stephen Carton, Stephen Winyard, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, Walter, William Connolly, and William Martin. Our EP shout-out this week is to Sorcerer Sanguine, so let's focus on the Sanguine part of the name and talk about fun facts about blood. Blood appears as a word in every Shakespeare play. The Beast, the informal name for the U.S. President's vehicle, includes a store of the President's blood, just in case something terrible happens. Crabs tend to have blue blood, earthworms and leeches tend to have green blood, and many invertebrates such as starfish have a clear to yellowish blood. Type O positive is globally the most common blood type, with about 40% of all humans having it, and in addition to the ABO plus rhesus factor, 42 other systems are used to specify the surface proteins of blood, but generally don't come up except for rare cases and diseases. And finally, your blood plasma compatibility is the inverse of your blood type compatibility. Thanks, Sorcerer Sanguine. Rather listen on YouTube, search Mage the Podcast on YouTube to find our full library there. If you super like this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at magethepodcast@gmail.com or at magethepodcast on Twitter. We have a Hopin Discord community at discord.me/magethepodcast. Mage the Podcast is also on Mastodon at dice.camp/@magethepodcast. If you like us, please give us a review on the platform of your choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to magethepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality. Bye.